No pressure, but we know how you're feeling about this economy. Is that creepy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the 15th of October. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. A lot of big numbers with which to begin the program today, and then a much, much smaller number, and arguably it's the smaller one that is more of a problem. One is definitive about the political machinations surrounding the American economy right now, those negotiations over a relief bill. One is definitive at one's peril. But we seem to have arrived today at the proverbial line in the sand. By way of refresher, Speaker Nancy Pelosi and House Democrats want to spend $2.2 trillion on a relief bill. The White House, the President of the United States, and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, they say they are good with $1.8 trillion. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell today in Kentucky, though, said this.
You're correct. There were discussions going on between the Secretary of the Treasury and the Speaker about a higher amount. That's not what I'm going to put on the floor.
McConnell is going to put on the floor, he said, a $500 billion package. That'll be next week sometime. So those are the big numbers. The smaller number is $250. Just $250, no extra zeros. And it's one of the key data points from the latest edition of the Marketplace Edison Research poll. We're going to be digging into it for the next couple of days and today as well. But the upshot is that all is not well once you get past the economic headlines. One of the questions we asked people was, if you had an unexpected expense of $250, $250, would you be able to pay it? 47% of people, almost half of Americans, said it would be somewhat or very difficult to come up with that kind of cash.
Since the pandemic, it's been, we haven't really had much expendable income.
That's Ashley Zents. She's 27. She's a first grade teacher in Monterey, California.
At the beginning of the pandemic, my boyfriend was laid off from his cooking job. And so now it's kind of just my salary and then the little bit of benefits that he gets, which covers, you know, like rent, food, but only barely. Like there's not much else.
One reason why there's not much else, those expanded unemployment benefits, the extra $600 a week we told you so much about, they ran out almost 3 months ago. See also negotiations over those big numbers that we started with.
When he had the federal benefits, at least we had like a little bit of wiggle room where it was like, okay, if something happened, it wouldn't be like the end of the world right then. But now that that's gone, that's also kind of not there anymore.
Ashley Zents, one of the respondents to the 10th edition of the Marketplace Edison Research poll, out, as I think I've said, today. We threw some new questions in the poll this time because pandemic. And some of those questions were about kids and parents and working and schooling from home. Those are among the biggest challenges millions of people in this economy are facing. And as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, it is mostly women who are facing it.
Normally, Emily Smith supplements her job as an heirloom vegetable farmer in Ohio with a part-time winter job. But this year, she's got a lot going on at home. Her 9-year-old son is doing on-again, off-again remote school. It changes week by week according to infection rates in her county.
I have to be here. He's not really old enough for me to, you know, go anywhere.
One time while he was in class, she left to run a quick errand down the street.
I come home and it's like he's sitting in front of the TV with his computer in front of him. I'm like, no!
Smith's husband works full-time outside the home, so she's in charge of school time. Our Marketplace Edison research poll found a stark gender disparity in who's primarily responsible for supervising remote learning. 63% of mothers said they were, compared with just 28% of fathers.
These disparities have kind of already been there, but they're really getting exaggerated by how the pandemic has kind of taken away a lot of the scaffolding that makes working families tick.
Darby Saxby directs the Center for the Changing Family at USC. She says before the pandemic, women in heterosexual dual-income households were already doing more household labor, despite the fact that dads have tripled the amount of time they spend taking care of kids over the last 50 years. Now, with childcare hard to find and extracurriculars canceled, it's mothers who are mostly picking up the slack.
You know, women are generally socialized to kind of be more the managers of their kids' development and education.
In our poll, roughly equal shares of men and women did say they had made career sacrifices to care for family during the pandemic or had cut hours at work to deal with remote school. Like Thane Young in Philadelphia, who's juggling his IT job with studying for his BA and helping his five kids at home.
It's definitely taken away from anything else that I would have otherwise done, and that time otherwise would be consumed either with my career or my own education.
Dan Carlson at the University of Utah has found while moms are more likely to be in charge of remote schooling, dads have stepped up to take a more equal share of routine housework and childcare during the pandemic.
If men hadn't stepped up the way they did, it would have been even worse. So it was not enough to stem the tide. You know, it's like a finger in a dam.
The latest jobs report from the federal government found more than 800,000 women had dropped out of the labor force, four times more than men. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I guess the deal is traders are okay with no relief bill, or maybe they're just looking past the election. Don't know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's 30 weeks in a row now, 30 weeks that more than 800,000 people have made fresh claims for unemployment benefits. Or maybe a clearer way to say that is that every week for 7.5 months in this economy, more than 800,000 people have lost their jobs. That was the number out this morning. For most of those people, they've lost their health insurance as well. Since March, according to one study, almost 8 million people have lost jobs that provided coverage for them and their families. So we sent Marketplace's Andy Euler to looking at the risks that that presents during a pandemic.
That data on exactly how many people have lost their employer-sponsored health insurance is just an estimate. But Karen Politz at the Kaiser Family Foundation says,
we know because there's so much job loss and so much income loss that there are people who are certainly at risk for losing their coverage if they haven't actually lost it already.
But if that's your situation, there are some other options depending on where you live.
We've estimated probably 85% of them are eligible for either Marketplace coverage or for Medicaid coverage.
Even when those options are available, says Steve Woodbury at Michigan State University, the newly uninsured might not be able to get them.
This is very disruptive. You're moving from employer-sponsored plan to something else. And just the time that it takes to, you know, go about searching. And these people are worried enough already because they're unemployed. It's a hardship.
And Woodbury says a global pandemic is about the worst time to have more people without health insurance. Stan Dorn with the consumer advocacy group Families USA says it's because the uninsured are 75% less likely to go to the doctor if they need to.
So that means if you come down with COVID-19, and you don't know it, and you start experiencing symptoms, you are understandably going to put off getting care because you're worried about going bankrupt.
Dorn says the consequences of so many uninsured are huge, not just for those experiencing it, but for the nation as a whole. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
So that was people losing their jobs and health care coverage. On the flip side of the health care spectrum, seniors covered by Medicare, nearly 60 million Americans all told. Open enrollment begins today, and as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, this year is going to be a little bit different.
When open enrollment comes around, Medicare beneficiaries are usually bombarded with information, TV, radio, and online ads.
Comparing plans?
Oh, yeah. They sure can change year to year.
So people often need assistance in making a choice, says Casey Schwartz with the nonprofit Medicare Right Center. There are federally funded helpers who assist beneficiaries. But this year, with the pandemic,
in-person assistance is either limited or not available in some areas.
And that means it may be harder for some people to make decisions. This year, there are more options within some plans, including supplemental benefits that aren't quite healthcare, but are healthcare adjacent.
Meal delivery, transportation to medical appointments.
Laura Keohan is a health policy professor at Vanderbilt University. She says for many seniors, the cost of premiums is the most important factor when picking a plan. And these new benefits may cost more, but
some of those benefits might be more appealing in the time of COVID-19.
Many of these supplemental benefits were new last year. Keohan says there were 250 plans that offered these types of benefits. This year, there are expected to be more than 900. Gerald Kaminsky, a health policy professor at UCLA, says that's because
companies may have been cautious about immediately jumping into offering these expanded benefits until they had a better idea about what the cost implications might be.
Annie says with millions of Medicare beneficiaries, there's a lot of money at stake. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
If you're up early tomorrow or even at a reasonable hour, the Marketplace Morning Report is what you ought to listen to. David Brancaccio and the gang, all you need to know to start your economic day. This pandemic is in its eighth month now, if you count, as I do, from March 11th. Tom Hanks, the NBA suspended its season. Anyway, here we are. And the numbers are going in the wrong direction. New cases are back above 50,000 a day. And the fear is we're letting our guard down. We have gotten basically too optimistic. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong tells us, we don't always make decisions that match the evidence in front of our eyes.
There are two kinds of people in the world. There's the Tigger type, you know, from the Winnie the Pooh books, always looking on the bright side of life. And then there's Eeyore, always waiting for disaster. Turns out, most people are more like Tigger, says Tali Sherratt. She's a cognitive neuroscientist at University College London and the author of The Optimism Bias.
Optimism bias is our tendency to overestimate the likelihood of experiencing positive events, such as financial success, having a long, happy marriage, and our tendency to underestimate the likelihood of experiencing negative events.
Like divorce, illness, car crashes. 8 out of 10 people say they're above average drivers, according to AAA. So why the optimism? Well, let's take the pandemic. We get good news one day, we get bad news the next. But Sherratt has found that people underprocess bad news. They don't build it into their expectations.
We take in the positive a little bit more than negative. And in fact, we've done brain imaging studies that show that the brain encodes this unexpected positive information about the future better than unexpected negative information.
Optimism can be a good thing. It's tied to longer lives and less depression, but it can also lead to reckless behavior, over drinking, over borrowing, and being careless about COVID, according to a study Marie Helwig Larson is writing up. She teaches psychology at Dickinson College.
When people don't think they're personally at risk, they're less likely to wash their hands or engage in social distancing. So it's not just the ha-ha, we are bad at this too, when psychologists love to tell us how we are bad at things. It really does have consequences.
She says optimism bias is hard to overcome, but one way to fight it is to force yourself to develop good habits, like washing your hands over and over, count to 20, until you no longer think about why.
We don't brush our teeth as a result of some careful risk estimation of our cavity proneness. We don't stop wearing our seatbelts because we have not experienced seatbelts saving our lives. We just do those things because they're habits.
There is another kind of overconfidence experts worry about. Management professor Don Moore at the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business studies what is called salience. People overemphasize things they see, like the healthy people they encounter at the park or at the supermarket during the pandemic, and they downplay what they don't see.
The sick disappear. They're in isolation wards in hospitals. We don't see them. Another important dimension is the fact that those individuals who are being most cautious, they are also invisible to us. They're at home.
So it's easy to assume this COVID thing is no big deal. And there was a classic study on how we can draw the wrong conclusions just by looking at what's in front of us. It involves college students.
Many have the mistaken impression that others like to party and drink more than they do. Well, the shy people, they're in their dorm room studying, and the ones who you see on Friday night, those are the ones who like to get out and party and drink.
Behavioral economists call this problem thinking fast, which can lead to snap judgments that aren't always rational, sometimes making people overly optimistic. By the way, I was hoping to file this story a couple days ago. Turns out, I was late. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we had well over 500 people dig your own potatoes this year.
Oh, I know what I'm doing this weekend. Right now, though, we're going to do the numbers. Oh, come on. Dow Industrials down 19 points today, about a 10%, 28,494. NASDAQ down 54 points, about a 0.5%, 11,713. The S&P 500 gave up 5. That's about a 10%, 34.83. What you got to know, though, is that the opening bell, they were down 1% or more. So a little more context on those numbers I mentioned before. Andy Euler's piece on people losing employer-sponsored health insurance. The study I mentioned from the Employee Benefit Research Institute, the Upjohn Institute, and the Commonwealth Fund found, as I said, 7.7 million workers lost jobs that gave them health insurance. Here's the deal, though. Their 6.9 million dependents were affected as well, and the burden, this will not surprise you, fell disproportionately on women. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A little bit more from our latest Marketplace Edison Research poll. Now, a question we first asked 4 years ago that we thought was worth re-upping in this presidential cycle. Do you trust what the federal government tells us about this economy, the data and the indicators we use a whole lot on this show? 40% of Americans say they somewhat or completely don't trust that data. That is actually lower than those who answered that way in 2016. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, while the overall number is close to what it was 4 years ago, exactly who is skeptical of economic data now is very different.
Let's flash back to the 2016 presidential election, when a regular part of Donald Trump's stump speech was this.
Don't believe those phony numbers when you hear 4.9 and 5% unemployment. The number's probably 28, 29.
That wasn't true, but his supporters took his advice. Our polling in 2016 showed almost half of them didn't trust federal economic data at all. Then he won. And as then Press Secretary Sean Spicer said after some positive jobs numbers.
Yeah, I talked to the president prior to this, and he said to quote him very clearly, they may have been phony in the past, but it's very real now.
Now, just 7% of Trump supporters don't trust federal economic data. But when it comes to Biden supporters, 24% don't trust the data at all, up from just 5% of Clinton supporters in 2016.
The pattern that I saw in the data was that people are more likely to trust government data if they also happen to trust the people and the person who were in the White House.
Bruce Carruthers is a sociology professor at Northwestern University who focuses on trust issues. He says that connection between partisanship and trusting economic data is depressing and risky.
I mean, people rely on those economic data to provide, you know, signals for what they should do and how they should live their lives.
People like Tuli Katere-Verima in Chantilly, Virginia. I met her in a field outside her home, social distancing, you know. She and her husband are thinking of buying a house. They have a 7-month-old baby. She's one of just 7% of Biden supporters who still completely believes the numbers.
I make a distinction between economic data coming from the government and things our president says.
She's paying attention to data on housing and interest rates to inform her home buying decisions. But Katere-Verima also uses federal data to understand what's happening outside her community.
Sometimes what you are hearing on the news about what the state of the country's economy is might not at all be reflective of your own personal situation.
That's exactly why James Allen Jones in Johnson County, Kentucky, says he doesn't believe federal economic data at all. There are few jobs in his rural area, and he says economic conditions are pretty bad.
It's like just what they want you to hear is all they want to tell you. A lot of stuff that comes out that
They tell you one thing and then come find out it's a different thing, especially like welfare and unemployment, stuff like that.
He's a proud Trump supporter, but he's skeptical even of what the president says about the economy.
He has to go by what they tell him.
They being other federal officials. This kind of partisan divide over economic data contributes to policy gridlock, says Laura Veldkamp, a professor at Columbia Business School.
If we can't agree on a common set of facts, it has pretty deep repercussions for what we're able to achieve collectively going forward.
Because, she says, one of the things economic data can do, if people believe it, is help people and lawmakers prepare for the future. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Picture, if you will, the ideal fall day. Changing leaves, crisp weather, you need a sweater maybe. And what about some apple picking? This is high season for a lot of pick-your-own-apple places and pumpkin patches, too, which is also the setup for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
I'm Al Rose from Red Apple Farm in Phillipston, Massachusetts, and I'm a fourth-generation farmer. The demand has been kind of through the roof. It's been unprecedented. It's kind of, my wife and I correlate this year almost like a brand new, like a startup year for us. So not only do we have all the COVID adaptations and, you know, every year we do have quite a few new employees that, you know, for the fall season. But this year, you know, we weren't expecting to have the same busyness in the fall that we would normally. We thought we'd more ease into it, especially early September. But the demand was right from Labor Day weekend was huge, probably 50% higher. For the last roughly 20 years, we've had dig your own potatoes. But primarily in the past, it's the school groups that love and do sign up to do it. You can imagine kids love playing in the dirt. But this year, people are ecstatic about it. We had well over 500 people dig your own potatoes this year, and it was the quickest we ever got through our potato field. In French, the word for potatoes is pomme de terre, which is apples of the earth. So this year, people were getting apples off the trees and apples out of the earth, and we're having a brand new experience. And we know next year we're going to have to double our potato field. In 2019, we had a really bad hailstorm, and about 60% of our apples got damaged or dinged, and it was a really tough crop to grow and to harvest and to sell. And that was the year that pushed us in getting into hard cider. We made a lot of hard cider that year. But we kept saying that, well, we can't wait for 2020. It's going to be so much better and so much easier. But little did you know. But that being said, I just, you know, I do feel that it also shows a year like this that, and this happened in 2001, you know, 9/11, we had a lot of people that came to the farm. People, again, needed to connect with something that was tangible, something that there was a security and authenticity and a realness of being at a farm. And we're seeing that this year with COVID as well, where, you know, the farm really resonates with people. And also shows me that, optimistically speaking, that we're in a business that, yes, we're providing food, but We're providing a family farm, and there's a value and a connection there that we hope we can make in another 100 years.
Al Rose, Red Apple Farm in Phillipston, Massachusetts. Do let us know what's going on in your economy, would you? And then we will tell your story on the radio. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of it is going to be interesting to see how this one goes. I don't know if you heard about the Twitter kerfuffle yesterday. The New York Post published a deeply questionable story about Joe Biden and his son Hunter. We will spare you the details, but the upshot was that Twitter blocked people from tweeting that story out. Partisan outrage ensued. The Senate Judiciary Committee said it's going to subpoena Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey to answer for it. And this is the news, this afternoon, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Ajit Pai, said he is going to issue guidance as to what the law says online platforms are allowed to do and not do. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996 is the relevant statute at hand. And for the second day in a row, a bit of shameless self-promotion. Molly Wood and I talked to the guy who literally wrote the book on 230. His name is Jeff Kossoff. You can find that on the podcast we do together. It's called Make Me Smart. Check it out. All right, we're going, but here's your Thursday moment of economic context. A lighter note for a change. Randall Quarles, the vice chair of the Federal Reserve, gave a speech today about lessons learned thus far in this pandemic by the central bank. And he got to talking about things the Fed did early in the crisis to shore up the financial system, which was a lot of things. And then he said, and this is a quote, "I won't review in detail the kaleidoscopic gallimafry of actions that we took." Gallimafry, it's a noun. A confused jumble or medley of things. Kind of love that, right? All right, quickly, Amir Babawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, and this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.